week of March 10th, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 440, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York City, I'm Michael Gill. It's great to be back in the city here at the penthouse of my friend on Park Avenue.
Oh, you're in a penthouse.
Well, yeah, penthouse-ish.
Okay, well, that might be why our voices sound so different.
Well, we're also trying a new audio system, but I was traveling. I was down in Birmingham celebrating my mom's 90th birthday, stopped and visited my brother in Allentown, Pennsylvania, and now I'm back in New York.
Wow. Well, I'm welcome back, although I'm not there, so I can't welcome home, I would say, I suppose.
Sure, there you go. And last week, we were wondering and thinking and assuming that while A Star Is Born, the soundtrack was number one, we thought the single Shallow would hit number one, too, and yes, in fact, it did. So one more prediction by us. Not a very brave one. Everybody said it was going to be number one, but it was, it is, and maybe it will be.
Wait, what? It's going to be number one again, you mean?
Right. It could be. You never know. Probably not. It probably was a one-week push from the Oscars.
Well, that was last week on Showbiz Sandbox. This week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're tackling the showdown between the Writers Guild of America and their agents. We kind of mentioned it last week at the head of last week's show. And the WGA... they want to upend the way business has been done in Hollywood for decades, okay? The agents in the other corner want their conflicts of interest to get even more, well, I guess, conflicted. More money for everyone, they say. And we've got Jonathan Handel, an entertainment attorney and Hollywood Reporter contributor here to talk with us about it all. We'll cover the conflict at the end of the show during our Inside Baseball segment. And guess what? The busy officials at the WGA are also in the news at the top of the show thanks to their filing an arbitration claim against Netflix and how Netflix decides on residuals. Apparently, Netflix has a conflict of interest, too. In movie subscription news, we've got an update on Cinemia. They just pulled their one-movie-a-day offer and replaced it with a buffet of options that are harder to explain, but perhaps easier on the bottom line. In book filter news, we find out that Michael's pick last week was indeed already optioned, and now they're moving ahead with plans for Don Winslow's Border Trilogy. During our sexual misconduct section, Warner Brothers is in the spotlight thanks to serious allegations against CEO Kevin Sugihara. The studio is now investigating Sugihara and has already apologized for past mistakes. I guess Sugihara has already apologized for past mistakes, and they both hope that will keep critics at bay. But will it? Probably not. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And we've got a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, The New York Times, The LA Times, and you, our listeners. And the number one movie around the world is Captain Marvel, $455 million. That's about it. Nothing else matters.
That is a lot of money.
That is a lot of money. There's so much to say. Let's run through the chart and then come back to Captain Marvel, which I did see over the weekend. Did you?
I did not see it. I actually saw a movie called Snatchers, which is from 2017, but it showed at the South by Southwest Festival, and it's a very Sam Raimi-esque kind of comedy horror. It's actually kind of fun.
You think it'll get a commercial release?
I hope it does. I mean, I think it would definitely, you know, I don't know about a wide release, but it could make some money. It could definitely get a bit of a cult following. It's kind of funny.
So Captain Marvel is the number one movie around the world by a country mile. It reinvigorated the North American box office, made headlines all over the world. There's a lot to talk about it. At number two around the world is How to Train Your Dragon 3, $36 million on the weekend, $435 million worldwide. This movie is falling a little bit farther, faster than the first two movies. They're sort of tracking ahead of it at this stage in its release. So it looks like this movie will probably end up just around where the first two did. So the final film in the trilogy is not going to get an added boost at the box office. And number three is Green Book, another $30 million on the weekend, $240 million worldwide. At number four, the opposite end of the spectrum, is the disappointing Alita, Battle Angel, another $14 million on the weekend. It's at $380 million worldwide. It's still chugging along, but clearly this one is going to barely scrape by in terms of profitability.
And number five is... You mean Battle Angel, Alita Battle Angel. You think it's not going to... Well...
Yeah, I do mean...
$400 million, it's at break even, but barely.
Well, no. $175 million, which is the budget we believe is somewhat accurate, and it looks pretty expensive, would be $525 million. So it's $140 million short right now.
Yeah, and I don't know that they spent $175 marketing that film.
They didn't.
No, they did not.
Right. No, that's, in fact, another little detail that's interesting about Captain Marvel. But they still, no matter what you spend, you want to triple your budget worldwide. Especially yes. when a lot of your money came in China, where you only get 25%.
That is very true.
Tyler Perry doesn't get his movies released in China, unfortunately. I think a lot of money has been left on the table by his long-running series about Madea. And this series is coming to an end. $12 million this weekend, $46 million worldwide. But he makes money in North America, and everybody's happy. And number six is a Japanese film, Natsume's Book of Friends, the movie, tied to the temporal world. That's the full name of the movie, which is based on a Japanese manga. It made about $11 million in Japan and some other territories, but now it's opened up in China and immediately doubled its worldwide box office. $10 million on the weekend, $22 million worldwide. So yet again, we see how important China is becoming to every country. I mean, this is where half the world's box office is going to be done. The two biggest markets are North America and China. At number seven is The Lego Movie 2, another $7 million on the weekend. That's at $165 million worldwide. And number eight is the Chinese sci-fi flick Wandering Earth, at $5 million on the weekend, $682 million worldwide. Since it's not going to open up anywhere else, I believe Netflix has worldwide rights outside of China and the few territories it's already open in. Like, that means Wandering Earth will tap out at about just under $700 million. A great success story, especially when you consider it's almost all from one territory. Scrolling down the list, there are one or two other movies to mention. Bohemian Rhapsody, that's at $875 million worldwide. The French comedy, What Have We Done to God? That's the movie about the family with four daughters who all marry a man of a different faith. That's it. The new, this is the second film, I believe. $60 million they're about to hit from France and two other territories. It's a huge amount of money, amazing amount of money. I've got to imagine someone in Hollywood is remaking this film as we speak. And since we love to capture any new films that pop up, there's another French film on the list at number 20, The Mystery of Henry Pick. It's a French comedy about a publisher who discovers an unpublished masterpiece in a library that's devoted to collecting rejected manuscripts. If you write a novel and you send it into the publisher and they reject you, this library will take your book. They'll put it on the shelf. A cute idea, and apparently hilarity ensues, but presumably of a brainy nature. That movie opened up to $2.1 million in France. But that brings us back to the number one film in the world, Captain Marvel. I saw it, and it was okay, but boy, was it a big hit at the box office.
$455 million. Yeah, that's a hit.
They had all sorts of records that fell, movies led by women, Marvel movies without men in them, you know, blah, blah, blah. But the big one that matters is it's the 18th biggest weekend of all time in North America. There are also stats for international and worldwide, but those are a little less important because movies never really opened up this big. So it's a very short time period where you had movies opening up worldwide. So yes, it is the sixth biggest opening all time worldwide. And it's the fifth biggest internationally. Those are all great numbers, but those records will fall because more and more movies are being released worldwide. This movie has opened up everywhere except Japan. In China, it made $90 million over the weekend. And here's a fun fact. Most of the audience for Captain Marvel, men. 55 to maybe even 58% of moviegoers were males, unlike Wonder Woman.
Well, that's by a slim majority, Michael. 52% were women, probably taking their boyfriends. And so, I would say a few women went in women's groups, and that put it over the line. So it's 52% women.
Right, for Wonder Woman, while this movie is 55 to 58% men. So it just shows, yet again, making diverse movies does not mean you're limiting your audience. It means, if anything, you're expanding your audience. There's no reason guys won't see a movie starring a woman if it's good and they like it. It didn't get great reviews, actually.
Do you think that maybe that the, the fact that it's Marvel caused more men to go because, you know, basically Marvel has this following and there's this long, you know, 19 film, you know, arc where, you know, you got to keep up with the storyline. So people that watched Iron Man, that watched the Avengers, they're going to go see Captain Marvel, whether it's a woman or an alien starring in the, which I think it's both, in fact.
it's an illegal alien, but we'll get to that later.
Ooh.
Not necessarily, who knows? But you're right, that's absolutely true. You know, men care about Marvel, of course. They're very heavy moviegoers. And women have been waiting 50, 60, 70 years for a Wonder Woman feature film. So there's a long pent-up demand for Wonder Woman, whereas Captain Marvel, nobody's been waiting around for that one because people barely know who Captain Marvel is. Another feather in the cap for Disney and Marvel because they turned this into an event film. Ant-Man, Captain Marvel, Doctor Strange, Iron Man. These are not slam dunk superheroes like Batman. These are secondary characters I know little to nothing about until I looked them up online. So wow, turning that into an event movie is pretty big news. One other thing, though, I wanted to ask you. We said it opened up worldwide, and those records will fall again and again because people can do that now easier. There's no reason why 20, 30, 40 years ago, a movie couldn't have opened up worldwide, but logistically with physical prints, it's just so hard. I have to assume digital prints make all of this cheaper and, of course, so much easier to do.
Yes, absolutely. You hit the nail on the head. Digital cinema is making the logistics of day and date releasing around the world possible, you know, number one, easier. And frankly, they also do it to try and skirt piracy, because if you open in North America and somebody's got that camcorder recording out there day three, then everybody in Japan and China and everywhere else can download it, and you're going to lose a fraction, if not more, of your audience.
Now, on IMAX in North America, this movie grossed $14 million. That's in North America for Captain Marvel. Worldwide, it grossed a lot of money in IMAX in that format. Is 10% of the box office about where we should expect IMAX to be these days for an event film, or is that lower or higher than you expect?
I think it's probably right around where they want it to be, somewhere between, like, you know, 6% and 11-12%. 12% would be, they'd be ecstatic, I think. But they really do expect it to be in the 8%-9% range. Depending on the movie, a big movie like Captain Marvel, yeah, they would love a 12% because they're really taking up all the IMAX screens. And of course, keep in mind that when you run a film on IMAX, you are kind of locked in to that theater for a good 2 to 4 weeks, usually four.
Mm-hmm. So world, that's not getting more flexible since they have so many FOMAX now. You know, these screens, do they lock them in when it's not even a real IMAX screen? Do they care that much?
It's not so much that the exhibitors care. It's that the distributors, the studios are forcing the issue. And so, you know, there are times where a film could have made more on IMAX if the distributor had released it in IMAX. However, they were forcing the issue on the first film they had released in IMAX, and so they didn't release a particular title in IMAX.
One fun stat about IMAX, worldwide, the Marvel Cinematic Universe, the movies that are in that official grouping, it doesn't include all Marvel movies, but it includes a lot of them, they have grossed $1 billion in IMAX alone.
Wow, okay.
But I guess since those movies are looking at probably $10 billion, if not more, and you're still looking at 7, 8, 9, 10% of the total box office, even worldwide.
Correct, yes.
Fact. I was intrigued, though, how 3D has not been mentioned by anyone in any way, shape, or form. Critics have not mentioned what the movie's like in 3D, mainly because they didn't see it in 3D. The studios didn't screen it for critics in 3D. It's on theaters in 3D, but darned if you can find out how it did at the box office or why anybody would care about that. It shows you how far and fast 3D has fallen, at least in North America.
Oh, in North America, it's considered dead. Same in Europe. It's like, you know, barely, you know, if they can get to 30%, they're like over the moon. But it's usually around 15, 20.
And that's opening weekend.
That's opening weekend, correct. Yes, I'm only talking about, or even really the entire gross of the film. I mean, if it's 30% for the gross of the film, forget about it.
That's even 10 times better.
Yeah, there's champagne corks.
We're back where we were with Avatar. If a movie is made in 3D and it's meant to be seen in 3D and they're talking about the 3D, then people will maybe spend the extra money to see it in 3D. Otherwise, I think the bloom is off the rose.
You know, I would have seen Alita in 3D if I could actually have gone to see that movie in 3D. I would have gone.
Yeah.
I just was traveling at the time. But because I know they spent so much time and effort making a 3D version of that film because it was, you know, shot natively in 3D, I would have seen it that way.
Oh, it was intended to be seen in 3D?
Oh, absolutely. Think about it. It's a James Cameron movie, so absolutely.
Oh, well, that's very interesting. And now I'm going to contradict myself, because the one other big story at the box office in North America, where Apollo 11, a documentary about the race to the moon, is in theaters. It broke into the top 10 this week because it expanded to about 400 screens, and it grossed over $1 million this weekend alone. It grossed $1.3 million. It got booted off the IMAX screens by Captain Marvel, and that's a shame, because everyone I know who has seen this documentary says it's just great, and the few that I know that saw it in IMAX say it's absolutely worth seeing in IMAX if you can do it. Maybe it'll come back to the screens in a few weeks, because they said it's really an immersive, amazing film. It really works well in IMAX. I'm going to go see it in 2D or IMAX. I don't care. I shouldn't say 2D or IMAX. I should say regular or IMAX, because I really want to see it. And anybody who likes it, check out the classic documentary film For All Mankind. That's on the Criterion Collection. It sounds like it's a very similar pattern. They just found footage from the space program and crafted a film out of it. This movie is supposed to be just great, and it's yet another example of documentaries really kicking it in at the box office. When you look at the independent theater chains, the ones that depend on art films and documentaries and things like that, they're always looking for those movies that make $10, $15, $20, $20 million. Those are big hits for them. And this year, it's been documentaries, you know, and last year, you know, Mr. Rogers, Three Identical Strangers, RBG, Free Solo, and now the Peter Jackson documentary. Those movies bring in people. They have big legs. They run for weeks and weeks and months and months. Theater chains have to love those.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Peter Jackson documentary, We Shall Not Grow Old, I think it made like $4 million in North America alone.
No, it's at $17 million.
Take that back, $17
million.
It's got
more screening scheduled. It just keeps going on and on and on. No, it's one of the big hits of the year, of the last 2 years.
Did I just totally miss that you had said $17 million and then try and backtrack it and try and squash it down to $4 million?
No, I didn't. I hadn't mentioned a dollar gross for They Shall Not Grow Old, but that's true. It's doing just big business. And if you go on your phone, look at any movie time app, you'll see that there's always some scheduled screenings coming up in a week or two. They just keep rolling it out and having special screenings for it. And some other movies that can't be seen in movie theaters include Netflix movies. A lot of them only play on Netflix. And the WGA is challenging how they figure out when to apply which residual formula to what movies. It's not that complicated. The WGA, the Writers Guild of America, has filed an arbitration claim against Netflix. It questions how Netflix decides on what residuals to pay based on what formula. Basically, if a movie plays in a theater, one type of formula should kick in. If it only plays on streaming or TV, another formula should perhaps kick in. Now, since Netflix makes its own films and sells them to itself, it's sort of a form of self-dealing, so they get to be the buyer, the seller, and decide what formula to use. And the WGA is asking, are the films that are also shown in movie theaters getting the proper residual formula? They're not TV movies, but do they fall somewhere between that and full-on theatricals? You know, it's a big question, it's a big issue, and they want to take it to court, or at least an arbitrator.
Yeah, you know, I always wondered how they were going to work this out, because one of the things, at least with actors, is that it used to be that you would kind of get your fee, right? And then you'd get residuals based on, you know, the film selling to cables, the film selling to TV, the film selling, again, you know, airing on different broadcast outlets. And sometimes those residuals were kind of hilarious because they would be, you know, like 2 cents, you know, you'd get a check for 2 cents. Right. And you always see that on Instagram. Look, I got my residual check for that film I did 15 years ago. And yeah, that is kind of humorous. But, you know, you get enough of films, you get enough of a career, and all of a sudden you're getting residuals for 30 films or 30 television shows or a mixture. And it kind of amounts to something every year.
Absolutely.
But the problem is that Netflix doesn't sell to broadcast. Netflix doesn't sell to airlines. Netflix doesn't sell to premium cable.
That's why Netflix, you want a bigger upfront paycheck.
And so people were getting bigger upfront paychecks, knowing that, yes, okay, I might make my $1 million salary that I would make on any film. But of course, I'll get another $500,000 over the lifetime of this film through all of the residuals. In this case, it's no, you're making $1 million and that is it. And so the question for writers has been, well, wait a second, how do we price ourselves? Well, now we're seeing that that's an issue.
Right. And how does Netflix decide which formula to apply?
And well, Netflix applies the we're paying you once formula.
Well, there is a residual formula and they are shown in theaters. And Netflix does have third market stuff like Blu-ray and DVD and stuff like that. So,
okay.
You know, there are other markets where they sell off to. And I assume there must be territories where they aren't available that they might sell their films to or TV product. Who knows? All I know is I went to see Captain Marvel on the weekend and I used my Cinemia pass. We had the Rafit, the head of Cinemia, on our show last week. Was it just last week? Seems like yesterday.
2 weeks ago, two or three weeks ago.
And I had a rude awakening. My card worked great, but it also said your plan will not be renewed and you need to pick a new one because Cinemia has dumped the all-you-can-watch subscription. So just weeks after Cinemia assured us they could be profitable, charging $30 a month in North America for one movie a day every day, they are dropping that subscription option. Instead, much like MoviePass, they are offering a basic plan that includes only 2D and an elite plan that includes 3D and IMAX. It's all a little complicated, and the basic plan seems so unimportant, I can't imagine anybody caring about it. The elite plan, you can get 3 tickets a month for $25 or 2 tickets for $20. It's kind of like what MoviePass offers. Or you can pay 12 months up front and get a lower rate. So we're going to have to see. Are they going to lose people as they switch to a new plan? Will people just give up? Are they going to feel like they've been jerked around or not? But, you know, obviously, I think there are two lessons to be learned. The first is that one movie a day plans do not work unless you make a deal first with theaters and or studios, right?
Well, yeah, and theaters, I can tell you that AMC and Regal are most certainly, and that's here in the United States, they're certainly not going to offer up a piece of the ticket price. They've already
But it could be lower ticket prices, bulk buying or something like that.
And that is exactly how MoviePass was working with Landmark Theaters. They would go and they would buy 5,000 tickets at a time. They would burn through that in the first weekend, basically. But that gave them a guaranteed lower pricing. Right. That's basically what it did.
So yeah, we all agree you cannot make this work unless you work with studios and the theater chains and some arrangement is made, profit sharing, discounted tickets, something. But I think the other important lesson is that, you know, an all-you-can-eat buffet plan is still very appealing to moviegoers. It doesn't have to be at that, you know, crazily low $10 a month. I was very excited by it at $30 a month. I went to a lot more movies when I was free to go as often as I wanted. And I went to see movies I would never pay to see right now. So,
well, that's actually part of the problem. And what I mean by that is that, and Regal had this rule when Amy Miles was there before Cineworld took over, that 2% of their patrons were
crazy heavy,
like out of control. Like they accounted for between 10% and 15% of revenue, and they had this rule: you cannot institute any new product or program if it let's just say F's, and you can kind of fill in the blank. If it F's with the 2%, it ain't flying, because they knew that anything that got that lowered the average ticket price for that 2% would actually lower their revenue. So they couldn't do something like a movie pass, because that would mean that they would be taking people that were paying full freight and basically giving them
Do they make more money off them buying popcorn and soda if they at the same time lowered their insanely high, you know, concession prices, made them a little more affordable for people who went all the time? If they also realized that an all-day movie, you know, one-a-day movie pass could have greatly appealed to people who aren't heavy moviegoers. I'm not going to movies like those people. I'm not that person, but I am when you give me the opportunity to do it. And suddenly I'm seeing more movies, talking about the movies, telling people they should go see the movie. And, you know, I just still think that it's perhaps more of the future than they should, you know, or maybe they're missing out on an opportunity here.
Well, you know, I think that one of the things that Tim League and Alamo Drafthouse, which is running a test right now of its subscription program, all-you-can-eat subscription program in Yonkers, New York, at that one theater, what they realize is, for instance, their heaviest, ticket buyer or patron saw 400 movies last year in 2018.
Well, that's obviously silly, yeah.
Yeah, and they said, but if you look at that and you look at people that were seeing 300 movies or 280, like if you look at that and you say, okay, the average ticket price is $10, again, you know, kind of an average, and you say, okay, we're going to give that person
That's not the, we're talking about the 98% of people, 99% who are not that. That's,
but that is really, and this is this, you know, I know we're kind of off the rails here on this and we probably should have already wrapped up, but what they have determined, and by they, I mean the exhibitors and those that are running these programs, is that the heaviest users are the ones that immediately adopt. And you always lose money on those heavy users.
Of course, absolutely.
The hard part is getting to the people at the next tier of that pyramid, okay, which are a broader group of people that may every once in a while not go as often. So
well,
they
that's,
might.
That's. I mean, we've long argued that movie going is static and positive. That people do go to movies. They continue to go despite all these other options. Nonetheless. I'm in a major city. I don't go to movies that much. It's too expensive. I would go to a lot more. That's just the simple fact. I'm not a heavy user of movies because it's too darn expensive. And then when you get there, I never buy popcorn maybe once or twice a year because that's crazily expensive. So when you worried about your heavy users and you're ignoring the fact that you've got a box office and your movie going to static and audiences that are getting more and more out of the habit of going to the movies. That's what you talk about, get people going to the movies. And I think these plans maybe should be in the mix. Maybe it's not one a day, but maybe it's four a month or five a month, six a month.
Six movies a month would be hard for, you know, I don't know, maybe a student to, you know, a college kid could do it.
Right. I mean, four a month even. Yeah. You know, that's one a week. That's easy to think about. Oh, I can go to a movie a week.
Yeah.
And people will buy it who won't use it, just like the gym membership. And, you know, someday they'll be going to the movies or they see movies and they see TV shows and they make no distinction. They see a TV show on streaming. They see a movie in the theater. They see a movie on their iPad. They see a TV show, you know, at the season finale of Game of Thrones played in movie theaters. You know, it's a great big blurry world. And that's why I was excited in Book Filter when we found out that Don Winslow's Border Trilogy, I named the final book in this trilogy our pick of the week 2 weeks ago. And I had tried to find out whether it was ever optioned. I assumed it was. And yes, in fact, it was. The entire trilogy was optioned by Fox, the film studio, now owned by Disney. But the story was just too...
Well, not yet. Not yet.
Yeah, almost. The story was just too sprawling for a feature film. And it sort of just sat there for years now, 10, 15 years. Sort of got lost in the shuffle. But now with Fox merging with Disney, turning the book into a TV series in FX has become a new priority. Now they're looking at doing a TV show a la Sons of Anarchy. They've got it into gear again. They're looking at making really, I guess it'd be a really long miniseries in a way, because it's going to have a beginning, middle, and end, like Breaking Bad. They may have a five-year plan and say, this is where the series is going to go, assuming it works. So I'm excited for that. It's interesting. I think that's the best way to tell that story. It's too long and too sprawling to do as a film. It'll be fun to see how it turns out.
Well, I guess if you're mentioning Don Winslow and his Border Trilogy, which we discussed last week, as you mentioned, I guess we must be in our Book Filter segment. And Book Filter is a book lover's best friend. It's where you can find out what you should be reading, because every week, Michael, you kind of...
Not when it's been corrupted, not when the database has been corrupted. So Book Filter's down at the moment. Very distressing. Oh. But we do have a little book news.
Oh, I guess so. Yeah, but now last week, because every week you bring us like one or two titles that are ready for their close-up, ready to be adapted for film or television. And last week you brought us the Border Trilogy, the latest entry to the Border Trilogy. And this week, I don't know if you have a pick for us, but you do have some book news.
That's right. Just a little quick one. Barnes & Noble, their sales in the third quarter, which ended in January, were flat. The good news is that non-book sales rose 4%. But that seems to be the case for them and a lot of other of these people who are booksellers like Indigo and other people. The non-book stuff is what's selling. Book sales fell 1%. Hey, that's actually, you know, down is the new up. When you only fall 1%, that's pretty good. The really bad news around their Nook division, which almost doesn't even matter anymore. It fell 21% compared to the same quarter 1 year earlier. But their total Nook division grosses were $24 million. That's not even a rounding error. I mean, that's just so minor, it doesn't even worth reporting anymore. So booksellers that are doing okay, the big chains, are only doing okay by selling more stuff that aren't books. That's really not good long term.
You know, when I saw your notes here on the Nook, I thought to myself, wait, the Nook still exists? Yeah, exactly.
And the answer, of course, is barely.
Yeah, well, speaking of still around, that brings us to our sexual misconduct news, which has been, well, now we're in our second year of coverage of sexual misconduct news. And, you know, just last week we were talking about Richard Plepler, who is the head of HBO, that, you know, now that, you know, AT&T and Warner Brothers, they won their second case, the government, which is trying to break them up or trying to prevent the merger, they appealed their antitrust case and lost again. And it looks like they're going to stick. That merger is going to stick. They decided to do some reshuffling, some reorg, and they got rid of Richard Plepler, who was the head of HBO for well over, it's about to be 30 years. And we thought, wow, that's a big decision. And they kind of raised Kevin Sugihara and a couple of other executives over there at Warner Brothers into more powerful positions. Midweek, I think I sent you a text that said, well, maybe they kept the wrong executive.
Yeah. But yes, because a scandal involving sexual misconduct has engulfed him.
In this case, it's Kevin Sugihara.
Yes, Kevin Sugihara. This story had come up before; it had been denied, but now all sorts of text messages have come out and been released, which show that in fact something did happen. He did behave inappropriately. He has apologized, and the story is that basically, he was introduced to her via Brett Ratner and or producer James Parker. This is actress Charlotte Kirk. There seems to be, in her mind, she had sex expecting to get auditions and roles. And she did get auditions. She did get some roles, but not enough. And she was not happy about it. And she wanted more. And it just went on and on and on. Brett Ratner tried to broker a deal. He said, I'll put you in one of my movies. We'll get you more auditions. But she never signed it. It never happened. So it's a very unpleasant situation. He did abuse his moral power. This is not an employee of his company, but you know, was there an exchange made? How seriously will Warner Brothers see this? This is not an employee he is actually harassing or abusing his position of trust. It's someone outside the company, so it's perhaps less germane to his job at the moment. It may be less of a conflict or less of a problem for Warner Brothers. It's certainly very inappropriate for a CEO to use his power in this way, and it's condemnable. But he might weather it as perhaps a private matter. The question is, will more women come forward or any employees of Warner Brothers? In that case, he'll have a much bigger problem. Not that this couldn't, you know, create a conflict and, you know, make them change their mind on Kevin. But at the moment, it seems to be an isolated incident as far as we know. It could take weeks, months, or years before more people come forward. But they didn't the last time this was brought up. But we now know there was smoke where there was, you know, there's fire where there was smoke. So, you know, their denials now. Oh, yeah, no, actually, you were lying. So that could be a problem for him. You know, you lie to your company about a problem. If you'd been honest about it 50 years ago, there you go. That might be less of a problem than lying to them and having to come out today. So it's an ugly situation. It is an abuse of power. Whether you will be fired for it, we'll have to see.
Well, one might even say that lying to your company is a big deal.
Absolutely.
Which means it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, hot on the heels of Disney, the Disney-Fox merger taking a hit for its shady accounting on the hit TV show Bones. We discussed this last week. Now Universal is facing the heat. The studio just got the bad news that they lost two legal battles in a long-running court case over the profits from the hit TV show Columbo. Wow, that is an old show.
Yeah, the judge said, oh, wait, I just have one more question.
Oh, Inspector. Yeah. A jury ruled that the creators did not wait too long to sue, and the jury ruled that the studio could not deduct distribution fees from the money owed. Rather hilariously, that case involves creators who waited, you know, 45 years before receiving their first profit participation check on the Peter Falk mystery series that generated at least $600 million during its lifetime.
Well, the next what profit?
Yeah, we can't find the nets. The next phase of the trial continues with the creators or their heirs asking for $135 million and the studio ready to argue they should be able to deduct the cost of a money-losing revival in the late 1980s. It claims is still in the red for $65 million. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. This is the second case in a week. So that's very interesting that these cases are bubbling up and they're going to set new precedent or maybe change the way the business is done. I think the funny thing here is this was such a massive hit that they revived it again, you know, a decade later, and they're like, well, but that didn't go so well, so we shouldn't have to pay profits from the first time around.
Yeah, that, you know, and I can tell you that on the books, those two are separate entities.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Rockstar Hozier, who broke through with the hit single Take Me to Church, well, he's singing hallelujah. His second full-length album titled Wasteland Baby has just debuted atop the Billboard Top 200 album chart. It's the first rock album to top the chart since Mumford & Son did it back in December with an album that received mixed reviews. It fell fast and last week popped back on to the charts at a lowly 175. Hozier hopes to do better since his debut spent more than 175 weeks on the charts. Like many acts, he generated significant sales by bundling an album with concert tickets, and his debut is just a few thousand copies away from going platinum on actual album sales alone, no streaming included. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, but it's nice to see sort of an old-fashioned act who had a single, toured, got great critical acclaim, built up his audience in a very natural, organic way to come through with the second album and see that and maybe deliver. The cool thing here is, yeah, 978,000 copies sold of his debut. He really obviously appeals to an older crowd because he's just like 22,000 copies away from literally going platinum on actual, I would say physical sales, but it does include digital sales, but people actually buying the album. We don't see that very much anymore, and that shows you how fervent his fan base is, or how old, I guess. You know, he's back on the charts. We'll see how long he lasts. I'm sure he's going to have a long and trying to keep that word of mouth going. Certainly last year we saw the music business, they generated $9.8 billion in the U.S. alone. And streaming is the main engine of that. So having someone who can also sell albums, that's pretty cool.
The Olivier Award nominations for theater in the UK are out, and Canada's Come From Away is one of the early favorites. The little show that could became a word of mouth hit on Broadway, and apparently it's happening again in the West End. The Oliviers are the UK equivalent of the Tony Awards, and a good way to spot what shows you'll want to see when they come to the United States or your part of the world. Tina, the Tina Turner musical, is already coming to Broadway, and the highly touted Wall Street drama The Lehman Trilogy is headed to off-Broadway. No word yet on the epic decade-spanning gay play, The Inheritance, but it was a big winner too, scoring 7 nominations, including Best New Play and Best Director for Stephen Daldry. Drawing comparisons with Angels in America, that play is sure to come to New York at some point, but whether Best Supporting Actress nominee Vanessa Redgrave will come with it is another question. Other shows that scored big include a revival of Company and the new comedy Home, I'm Darling. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's just the annual award, but it's cool to see and really is a great cheat sheet for knowing what stuff, you know, may be worth your time. I'm certain that we'll, you know, we're seeing the Tina Turner thing. There are other shows that hit big, but, you know, it's great when they get here. Home, I'm Darling sounded really clever and cool. I hope that gets here too.
Yeah, you know, I think that the title of that show, maybe it's too clever for its own good. It's hard to pronounce. Live Plus 3 is where it's at. If you work in TV or advertising, of course, you know Live Plus 3 refers to all the viewers who have watched a TV show within 3 days of its airing. Many of them, of course, watch a program they have DVR'd. And now The Hollywood Reporter has done a deep dive into the statistics. There's a word that's really hard to pronounce. Statistics. They did this deep dive on the current season. The Hollywood Reporter confirms what you might have expected. More than 90% of all shows consumed via DVR are watched within 3 days. Hey, it's not fun talking about Grey's Anatomy or This Is Us if you haven't seen the latest episode. So people might not watch it the night it airs, but they almost always watch it soon after. And the longer they wait, the less likely they'll bother. That is not true. I have a whole DVR filled with episodes of Lost that at one point I'm sure I'll watch.
Big deal, big Full House.
And Full House. Yes. Big deal or big whoop?
There you go. Now you've said it. I think it's a big deal. I think it's really important to know how people are using their DVRs. This makes perfect sense to me that they would not be, you know, waiting weeks or months to watch episodes that are on their DVR. However, there are the people who say, you know what, I'm going to wait till that season ends, or I'm going to wait till the series ends, and they're going to catch up with the show then. And that means they're not even DVRing it. So the way people watch TV has definitely changed. But when you are actively watching a show and you're DVRing it, you're not waiting a week or two or three. You want to watch Killing Eve or Grey's Anatomy right away. But those numbers are cool. I love getting them. I'd love to get them more consistently, and nobody does that chart. But what I really love are the C3 and C7 ratings. Those tell us how many people who are watching the show on a DVR actually watch the commercials, or I guess more technically, let the commercials run rather than fast forwarding through them. Man, if you've got those numbers for any show at all, or can compare two different types of shows, we'd love to hear from you.
Yes, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or like us on Facebook. Facebook.com/showbizsandbox is where our page can be found. Now, maybe Atticus Finch will be headed to court after all. Producer Scott Rudin generated a lot of bad press when he bigfooted a lot of small community theater companies into abandoning their plans to stage a version of To Kill a Mockingbird. That version was licensed in 1969 and has been produced all around the world. Now the publisher of that once authorized version is suing the estate of Harper Lee to affirm its rights and get $500,000 in damages. According to the complaint, this version has generated millions of dollars to the Lee estate over the years. When the new Rudin version, penned by Aaron Sorkin, was announced, the play publishers approached the Lee estate to confirm that already authorized productions were still okay, except for one production in Staten Island that was canceled because of its proximity to Broadway. They gave the green light to all those productions again. Only later did a different lawyer at the estate claim the other productions were illegal. So is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. It's a back and forth between Rudin and the estate of Harper Lee and the people who have the rights to this other version. But, you know, the more information you get, it sounds like they went the extra mile to make sure they were doing okay by this play and making sure everything was kosher, which makes what actually happened a lot harder to deal with. Whether they have enough damages to claim, you know, the other productions are going to go forward. People had to cancel things. Their name is muddy. People are questioning whether they had the rights to this early version at all, which of course Scott Rudin says they don't. So he's suing them. They're suing him. They're suing the Harper Lee estate. It's ugly, but they make a good case for themselves, I have to say. They certainly, according to themselves, and I can't imagine how they would lie about this stuff, they went the extra mile to make sure they were doing right and following the rules. And a lot of small companies got screwed over and their reputation suffered.
Well, right. And you might recall last week I said this very thing that really it's up to the publisher to check with the Lee estate and say, hey, you just sold those rights again? Is that possible? And if it is,
well, no,
is
everything- they said there were those different rights. Yeah. And they did. They said, well, we know we've got rights to this
right.
version.
And
we just want to make sure everything's cool, right? And they're like, yeah, everything's fine.
Yeah. They did their job. Yeah. You know, if that's true, they did their
that's
job.
That's what they say. Yeah.
Amazon Prime is launching a streaming TV series for India and the world, starring Akshay Kumar, one of the country's biggest film stars. It's an action drama that will span the globe. To promote the announcement, Kumar walked a runway at a fashion show with his clothes on fire. That's just to remind you that he's known as India's Jackie Chan and does his own stunts. Titled The End, the series is under active development with no set date for when it will start filming, much less be available. At the same time, Amazon Prime launched the drama Made in Heaven, which it promises will be edgy in content by the standards of Bollywood and Indian TV. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, the single show announcement is a big whoop, though it is a breakthrough. It's the first really big film star to be doing something for a streaming service. But the general tenor of like, we want business in India, we're creating original content for them, there's 1 billion people there, we want them to get access to our service and watch our shows. In that sense, I think it is a big deal. Just like you've got all these record labels moving in and trying to make sure their music is available on streaming services, Amazon wants to make sure they're creating original content that people in India and all over the world want to watch.
Speaking of streaming services in India, do you know how much Spotify costs in India? You'll never believe it.
A dollar.
Oh, okay, maybe you will believe it. It's $1.70.
Yeah. I mean, no, of course the numbers are different because it's a very different economy and a very, very different level of income. And they wouldn't be paying on credit card either. They would have some, you know, whatever mobile payment system is available there, they would be using that to make the payments. It's a whole new world.
Well, Michael, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, we're going to be talking to Jonathan Handel. He is of counsel at Troy Gold, which means he's an entertainment attorney, and he is a contributing editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Jonathan, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be back with you.
Jonathan, can you just bring peace between everyone? Can you do that? The WGA, the lawyers, the managers, the agents, can we just fix this whole mess? What's the mood in Hollywood? Are people scared about this? Worried? Do they feel like this is a cataclysm, or is this, you know, some negotiating thing that they'll come to the table?
Well, I think a bit of all of the above, and there is a lot of concern in Hollywood over this. What the Writers Guild is doing is to, looking to do, I should say, is really completely redefine the relationship between the Guild, writers, agents, and with it, the relationship between agents and actors, directors, studios, and streamers. Other than that, not much to see here.
Yeah. Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how was the play? So I guess we should try and catch everybody up. Basically, the WGA, which represents screenwriters and both for film and television, and I guess even maybe some radio, is saying, hey, our agents are not fairly representing us because they're also putting these television packages together. And so they're more interested in putting a television package together, an entire series, and bringing that to networks than they are in representing my best interests.
And they're also saying more and more agencies are developing affiliated, we're putting that in quotes, production companies that the agencies claim there is a, you know, wall between church and state, that the two sides never collaborate. Nonetheless, they feel like their agency is also now their boss. And how are you going to negotiate with your boss? You know, you're just not getting the representation, they feel. And I have to admit, everybody argues about how sad they are. They had meetings with lawyers and managers that were pretty disastrous. People have said things like, Writers Guild doesn't seem to know how the industry works. And they are upending the way business has been done for decades. Production, you know, packaging deals have been done for a long, long time. But I have to say, the gist of what they're saying, whatever the ramifications might be, the idea that your agent should only represent what's best for you is pretty simple to understand. And I have always felt for a long time that all these conflicts of interest are a problem.
Well, the industry is filled with conflicts of interest that are a problem. And the Writers Guild is not wrong that there is the potential for difficulty here. Let's consider a couple other headline facts, though. The Writers Guild, on the one hand, is saying that these new affiliated production companies are essentially the spawn of Satan. But guess who's in business with one of them? No less a person than Bo Willimon, the president of the Writers Guild East. He has his next deal, or his next show, is being produced by Endeavor Content, which is the affiliated production entity of William Morris Endeavor, the talent agency. Why? How does he square that circle? I asked his publicist, and so far I've received no answer to that question.
I suggest that Al Gore and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez also fly jets, but that doesn't mean they don't think jets should be powered a different way, or if there was other transportation available than a private car, they would use it.
Well, Willimon was not forced to do a deal with WME, with Endeavor Content. In fact, he is a client of CAA. But he decided to do a deal with Endeavor Content because, in fact, the deal he got was better by far than the deal that most people get with studios. And in fact, these affiliated production companies are offering most, if not all, of the writers better that they offer deals to. They're offering them better deals than the writers have been getting with the studios. In fact, the Writers Guild doesn't dispute that. But says that those are loss leaders and that those better deals will disappear when these companies, as these companies get larger. Maybe not.
Less hypocritical because he did it with another agency's affiliated. I mean, if he did it with CAA's, that might make him look, you know, that might be more to the point. He did it with a third party.
Well, but if these companies are, you know, should be eliminated and have no business being in existence, these affiliate production entities, according to the Writers Guild, then why is he doing business with any of them? You know, the spawn of Satan may come from a different hell, but why are you doing business with him if you think if he's the spawn of Satan?
Can we just rewind time just a bit? Because it used to be that packaging agents at William Morris or CAA or ICM or any one of these agencies, they would, you know, in the 80s, 90s, 70s, they would take their talent, and usually it was started with a writer or producer. They'd find the idea or the television series that they wanted to put together. They'd package it with talent, very often from their own agency. So an actor, a bunch of writers, some directors, and then take it to the networks. The networks would buy it, and the agency would then get kind of a packaging deal. And they could make lots of money off of that, way more than getting the 10% from the fees that they would collect from their clients. I guess that's changing. Is that the idea here? Is that now that the agencies are actually not only packaging for producers, but becoming the producers themselves, that's the problem?
No.
Is that correct?
Not exactly. We're mixing two issues here. There is some overlap, but they're separate issues. First of all, the way you described packaging is exactly right, and is still the case today, except that, in fact, it's not as much to the agency's advantage as it once was, because those packaging fees, the back end in the packaging fees, the percentage of profits that the agencies would get, is less likely to materialize today than it was back in the 80s and 90s. That's because there is less of a as shows go to streaming services rather than traditional networks, there's less of a back end. There's less of an aftermarket for a series. But so the Writers Guild objects to packaging, even as you just described it, leaving aside this issue of affiliate production companies. The Writers Guild objects to packaging because they feel that the fact that the agencies get their fees, their packaging fees from the studios, rather than collecting a 10% commission on the talent, including the writers, is itself a conflict of interest. It means, according to the Writers Guild, that the agencies are not properly or fully incentivized to argue for higher fees for the writer. And it also means that in some cases, according to the Writers Guild, that agents have actually killed deals because the studio in certain cases may have refused to pay a packaging fee. And so the agent says, you know, if we're not going to get a packaging fee, we're not willing to do this on a 10% commission basis. We're going to kill the deal. According to the Writers Guild, that has happened on occasion. Now, a couple of things. One is the writers save 10%, which is a lot of money, and the actors and directors do too, if a show is packaged rather than done by commission. That's number one. Number two, the anecdotes that the Writers Guild has offered of abuses are all anonymous. And so although I've requested to talk with the writers behind those anonymous anecdotes, there's no way to tell what both sides of the story were, whether the anecdote is accurate, whether there was another reason that the deal was killed, whether the writer, you know, even whether the writer and the anecdote even exist independent of the Writers Guild anecdote here. And we have no way of knowing how many anecdotes the Writers Guild may have received of writers saying, you know, in my experience, packaging was great. The agent found a star that fit with my script, and the series got made, and I made a lot of money, and so did my agent, and I don't begrudge them that. Those anecdotes aren't up on the Writers Guild website. So we don't know, you know, all sides of the story here, and it's difficult because the Writers Guild has a constituency, namely its writers. It's an overlapping constituency with the agents because the agents represent the writers as well. But for the Writers Guild to gain leverage that they feel is necessary in this disagreement, they need to rile up their constituency. And that's not always consistent with presenting, you know, both sides of an anecdote or both sides of an issue. Now, affiliate production is a separate issue. The issue here is that The agencies, or they're holding the holding companies that own the agencies, have set up sister companies, affiliated companies, that are displacing the role of the studio and are actually doing financing and production type activities around projects. Now, the agencies will say two things to this. One is, no one is forced to take a deal with an affiliate company. It's just another buyer in the marketplace. The affiliate company says, might say, we're not interested, or they might say, we're interested. If they say, we're interested, you can take the deal over at Disney or Universal instead if you want. But in fact, and this is number two, the agencies point out that the affiliated companies are offering better deals than the studios are. They're offering a larger share of the back end. They're offering more creative control. The reason that Bo Willimon is in business with Endeavor Content is, in fact, that he gets to own a portion of the series. He actually gets an ownership stake, according to reports, in the show that he's making, which is basically unheard of for writers to have ownership. Usually what you do is a work for hire and the studio owns it, you know, lock, stock, and barrel. So there's no mystery why he would want to be in business with Endeavor Content. What is a mystery is how he squares that with the rhetoric that opposes companies, Endeavor Content and similar companies from CAA and UTA. Those three, WME and those other, and the other two, are the agencies that have set up companies of this sort. So it's become, very vitriolic. The Writers Guild says there's no compromising on matters of principle like conflict of interest, but the fact is, obviously, there is. First of all, Bo Willimon has made this compromise, is in business with one of these companies. Secondly, another conflict of interest is that showrunners, who are writer producers, actually are the ones who hire the staff writers on their own shows and determine their salaries. And for their profit participation to be maximized, the profit participation of the showrunner, it's in their interest to minimize the salaries that they're paying to their fellow writers. Now, that's a direct conflict of interest, but that's the real world. The Writers Guild isn't talking about that. Finally, another conflict of interest. Any experienced agent, if you write action adventure, you want to be with an agent who's experienced in selling action adventure. Well, that agent no doubt represents other action adventure writers as well. And sometimes those writers are going to be in competition with you for an open assignment for the same job. That's a conflict of interest. Does the Writers Guild try to prohibit it? No. Instead, the code of conduct that they want to impose just wishes it away and says, we hereby deem that this is not a conflict of interest. The truth is,
but that's true now anyway.
That's exactly my point. When the Writers Guild says there's no compromise with conflicts of interest, in fact, there is a compromise with conflicts of interest, which is that here's a perfect example. Agents represent people who compete against each other for jobs. We accept that conflict of interest as a reality of the marketplace. And instead, what we do is we ask, as the new code does, that it be disclosed upon request of the writer. Who else do you represent that's competing for the same job? That's how we manage the conflict of interest rather than prohibit it.
Yeah, that was actually when working for an agency. One of the things you're told by agents and as an agent yourself, you try to minimize the number of times you have to reveal your other clients to a specific client because you don't want that particular client that's asking to think, well, every time I'm up for a role or up for
that darn Meryl Streep gets it.
Right, exactly. Well, Meryl Streep is an outlier where the studio is never going to offer that role to me. So of course Meryl will get it. That doesn't matter. It's when, you have several people that are all writing, as you say, action adventure films and they're all of the same caliber. Well, who is the agent pitching? Is it me or is it one of the four other people that could write that same film or television show for the network? You hope it's yourself and not the others.
Well, we've got a looming deadline. We've got an April 6th deadline where the members are going to meet. If nothing happens, they're going to ask their writers to fire their agents. It's going to be a huge deal if this gets to this stage. And maybe if Bo says, you know what? I'm a big name and I'm benefiting from the current system. I got a great deal, but maybe I don't think it's best in the long-term interest of the industry or the writers who aren't as successful as I am. And he says it still needs to change, even if I'm profiting from it right now. Maybe that's not so hypocritical. But surely the writers have some point. I mean, you seem to not think they have a leg to stand on. Why are they going this crazy suddenly if they don't have any particular beef and things are just the way they've always been and conflict?
I absolutely think they have a leg to stand on. I mean, it's quite clear that there's a potential for abuse in these practices. It seems likely that there has been abuse on occasion. And the Writers Guild is quite right to ask for, it would certainly be quite right to ask for guardrails to prevent abuses. Certainly would be quite right, I think, frankly, to ask for to be cut in on package fees. And that if a package fee exceeds a certain amount and the threshold to be negotiated or what have you, that writers and other talent should get a piece of that. That money that's coming from the studios. It shouldn't necessarily all go to the agencies. So I don't want to come off as saying that the Writers Guild doesn't have a position here, because I think that they do. They absolutely do. But I think that the headline that this is uncompromisable and a matter of principle, that's great for organizing your members. I don't think that that's a full and fair reflection of the situation, though. Nor is the agency position that, well, you know, agents only have clients' interests at heart and they wake up with halos on their heads. That's not reasonable either.
Well, the writers did outreach. They did a meeting with every lawyer that was willing to meet with them. All the lawyers, all the big agencies, all the big law firms sent people. They had another meeting with managers. Both of them seemed to be disastrous. Did you attend either of those, or did you hear from people how those went? Because from all accounts, at least in the trades, people went and the Writers Guild couldn't answer the most basic questions, you know, the sort of questions you would have to expect to be asked at those meetings. And people walked away saying things like, they don't seem to know how the business works. They had no answers for any questions. It was just a PR nightmare.
Well, that's right. I did not attend either of those meetings. I wasn't invited to either of them, but I spoke with 10 people. Over 10, I think, but at least 10, I think, four managers and six lawyers, who did. And your summary is exactly what the managers and lawyers conveyed to me. The managers considered it an abject effing disaster, in the words of one of them. And the lawyers, although more diplomatic in their language, agreed with the managers that they felt the Writers Guild didn't have the answers to basic questions, and both groups left very, very concerned, I think is fair to say.
But what happened to, I mean, years and years and decades ago, it used to be that agencies would also be kind of production companies. That was then outlawed. And of course, you know, I guess, was it MCA that was an agency?
Vertical Integration.
Yeah. And they just, Lou Wasserman took MCA into, you know, film production and music production, et cetera. And they decided, you know, to get rid of their clients. And to this day, an agency is supposedly not supposed to be producing content.
No.
Managers, on the other hand.
Well, it's not quite clear that agencies aren't supposed to be producing content. There isn't actually anything that says that, but that it has been the practice that agencies don't, and that these entities that they've set up are separate, although affiliated entities. Managers, managers, as you started to point out, do directly produce content.
Right. That's always been the issue. Is there a conflict of interest with managers and their clients? Because, of course, they, you know, a manager can be a producer of a television show that stars their client. But of course, it's in the manager's best interest as the producer to make sure that the television show costs as little as possible to produce, as you just pointed out. So, and that was always the case with agencies, that wasn't an issue.
Well, that's right. That's right. I mean, I think that if the Writers Guild succeeds in its campaign to reduce the power of the agencies, that they will go after the managers next on exactly this issue. The difficulty, you know, one of the sort of larger difficulties here is that if you reduce the power of the agencies and reduce the power of the managers and perhaps reduce the power of the Writers Guild, because you don't know how these legal disputes are gonna play out.
And the studio has the power.
That's right. And the studios are getting bigger and bigger. They're all, you know, they were once conglomerates, now they're mega conglomerates. Disney swallowed Fox. AT&T bought Warner, bought Time Warner, Warner Media. Comcast bought NBC Universal a number of years ago. What's going to happen with Paramount and Sony? Who knows? These companies are getting, and then of course the digital streamers are huge companies. So, you know, Netflix is enormous. Amazon is an enormous company. Apple is entering the market. They're an enormous company. You're talking just the largest companies in the economy, basically. And to think that, you know, you're going to reduce the power of writers' representatives, bring them to heel, and end up with, you know, figuratively speaking, with, you know, with two folks that smoking cigars on Ventura Boulevard effectively being able to represent writers, is a very startling, you know, picture, and not one that I think gives people a lot of comfort. I mean, one of the lawyers I spoke to said, look, this is good. If you reduce the power of the agencies, you reduce my leverage as a lawyer in representing the writer as well. You're reducing the power that the writer will have to negotiate against these large, large, large mega conglomerates.
Well, you know, you've made me pull back a little bit on my attitude on this issue. It's given me some things to think about. And yet, as at the beginning, my first thought went to Wall Street and how they wanted to pass a law saying, your broker, your stockbroker needs to have your best interest at heart. And they said, wait, what? No, we can't have that rule. That's crazy. You know, it just feels like agents should have the writer's best interest at heart. And it's hard to do that when there's so many areas where it necessarily isn't.
You're absolutely right that this is a very conflicted and complex landscape. And at the end of the day, it's a very difficult situation. I just continue to feel that a negotiated solution is more likely to be a satisfactory one than a litigated outcome.
And it's scary to know that the Writers Guild seems not to have their act together, at least when it comes to meeting with lawyers and managers when they're trying to make allies, and they mess that up completely. That's very worrisome in terms of their strategy and what they're doing and what they hope to accomplish. If they can't speak to journalists and make that clear, if they can't make it clear to other allies what their game plan is, good God, this isn't going to go well.
Well, it is concerning. It's concerning also that the Writers Guild apparently did not reach out to the agencies and try to negotiate these issues before, you know, beginning an aggressive campaign, an assertive campaign against the agencies. But, you know, there's a lot of blame to be held on the shoulders of the agencies as well. I mean, you know, it's not that many years ago that Mike Ovitz, the head of CAA at the time, was the most powerful individual in Hollywood and spoke openly about how he would send his black Armani-clad foot soldiers up and down Wilshire Boulevard, you know, crushing the enemy. That DNA, you know, lasts for a long time. And
although I will say,
yes,
I worked at CA during that time period, and I did have a black Armani suit, several of them.
Uh-oh.
And I've actually found them recently in the back of my closet and went, wow, did I actually wear that? Yeesh, that's way out of style.
Well, that's the thing. The question is, what is in style for a big agency today? And I'm not talking sartorially. That really is what the dispute is about. And we will learn on March 25th when the writers vote on the code of conduct, and then on April 7th when they intend to propose it if they haven't reached a negotiated solution.
Well, and it's that's interesting because I'm getting the feeling that peace in the Middle East might be easier to negotiate than this particular kerfuffle.
Well, I hope it doesn't come to reliance on Jared Kushner to solve these issues, but who knows?
Well, Jonathan Handel, a contributing editor at The Hollywood Reporter, thank you very much for joining us to help us unravel what the heck is going on between the Writers Guild of America and these affiliated agency deals.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to have been with you.
Well, that was great of Jonathan Handel to stop by. I thought he really did a good job of showing both sides of the story. You know, we were been presenting the WGA side a lot because it's easy for me to understand. And hard to understand how everybody else could say, oh, well, we got conflicts. But he made a good job of saying, you know, this is how the industry works. There are these conflicts. Both sides have some points to make. But it is concerning that we're heading off a cliff and they don't even seem to have a roadmap, much less enough gas in the car.
Well, if you were heading off a cliff, I guess that would be like an action movie, right?
That would be indeed.
Well, an action TV
fan would have been Jan Michael Vincent.
That's right. That's where I was headed with that. We are in our obituary section, and we have some sad news about Jan Michael Vincent. He died at the age of 74.
He died on February 10th, and it did. And only TMZ broke the news that he had died. I don't know why the press release wasn't put out or people, but he had a sad later part of his life. He dealt with some addiction issues. He was in drunken car accidents and things like that. I believe he had part of his leg amputated towards the end of his life. So he had been dealing with a lot of medical issues and health issues. But he had his glory days in the 70s and the early 80s. He was in movies like Hooper, which is about stuntmen. That was with Burt Reynolds. And White Line Fever, about truck drivers and surfers in the movie Big Wednesday. He was never a big film star, but he was a name. And then he segued into TV pretty nicely, didn't he?
Yeah, he did The Winds of War, which was the big blockbuster miniseries in the 1980s.
Ew.
Yeah, based on Herman Wouk's book. I remember watching it live. I was one of the live plus three.
I've never seen it on your VCR. I've never seen it, but I would be interested to know if it holds up. I'm feeling it probably doesn't. It plays more like a soap, but it was certainly epic and big in scope. And Robert Mitchum was in it. You know, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, and he was also in Airwolf. He was the star of Airwolf.
That was the biggest hit of his career. You know, I think it ran about four seasons, five seasons, something like that. But it was a big hit all over the world. I find it interesting. This guy had a very brief heyday in the 70s and early 80s. And I mean no disrespect to any family or friends or people he knew. But he sort of had faded from memory. But that stuff sticks in people's minds. And when he died, it was headlines all over the world. I mean, not like Prince or David Bowie, not to compare this or that or, you know, who got more press. But I found it interesting that there were stories in The Guardian in the UK and lots of other countries in attention. Just, you know, once you logged into people's brains, they remember you. And then you hear something about Luke Perry, who's on a hit show right now, or something like Jan Michael Vincent. His heyday was decades ago, really. Still, people remember.
Yeah, I think a part of the reason that he kind of faded was because he really had a lot of addiction problems.
And oh, yeah.
Very hard to work with because of that. And not because he was belligerent or anything like that, but just because, you know, you show up drunk to the set and it's like, okay, how do we get this guy to remember his lines? And he, toward the later end of his career, would be asked about his career. And he said, look, I've got to be honest. I don't remember being on this show or doing that movie. And
oh, that's very sad.
Yeah. Now, speaking of legends in the business, Sid Sheinberg. He was the CEO of MCA. How many times do you think we could say MCA on the same show? And which, you know, he ran Universal for like 25 years, okay? He died at the age of 84. He was one of Steven Spielberg's biggest champions.
He made one good decision, you know?
Bringing
Spielberg in. He made 1,000 good decisions, 100,000, you know, he made decisions every day. But my God, he watched Spielberg's student film, Amblin, which is like 23 minutes. The kid was 20 years old. And Sid Sheinberg signed him up to a contract, a 7-year contract to work at the studio. He really got him onto, was it Night Gallery, where he directed Joan Crawford in an episode of a TV series. Mainly had him working in TV, making TV shows, just getting his feet wet, getting behind a camera, being a director. And boy, oh boy, did that ever pay off. I mean, thanks to Spielberg and Sid Sheinberg's relationship with him, Universal had the highest grossing film of the 1970s, which was Jaws, the biggest film of the 80s, E.T., and the biggest film of the 90s, Jurassic Park. It paid off in a whole bunch of other ways, but oh my gosh, you know, that's, you can put that on your tombstone. And Spielberg, I think, among his, you know, praise for Sid and all the work he did and all the great decisions, he said, you know, I just can't even imagine a world where he's not around.
Yeah, you know, of course, he worked with Lou Wasserman over at Universal Pictures as well, which was one of the, you know, 25-year partnership, maybe longer.
I always picture the guys at Warner Brothers, Terry Semel and...
Bill Daly and Terry Semel.
Yeah, that's such a big partnership, and I forget that Sheinberg and Wasserman had the same thing going on over at Universal.
Yeah, you know, ironically, or coincidentally, I don't know. Take your pick of those words. But just last week, I was on Twitter, and I saw somebody had posted a memo that Sid Sheinberg had written to Steven Spielberg about a movie called Back to the Future.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to rename the film. He said, look, Back to the Future sounds like a sci-fi genre movie. It sounds way too much like a sci-fi genre movie. We need to rename it. And the name should be Spaceman from Pluto. And he had like all of these reasonings, and it was like an old-fashioned memo to Steven Spielberg from the office of Sid Sheinberg, you know, like all of the the executive notes from Sid Sheinberg and all of the reasons. I was like, oh my God. Like, in hindsight, it's like, are you kidding me? None of these notes make a lick of sense.
Well, and the whole book with him, with his battle with Terry Gilliam over the making of the film Brazil.
Yeah, so I guess I wonder, like, did Steven Spielberg at the time get them and just roll his eyes and go, oh my God, how am I going to try and get back to him and say, no, no, and as for this last one, well, no.
I believe it was Sid who really urged Spielberg to make Schindler's List, to option that book and make that movie, told him he had to make it. So, you know, they had a very productive relationship over the years.
I remember that when I was at CAA, speaking of agencies, when Ron Meyer left, he was one of the heads of CAA, and he left to become the head of Universal right after Sheinberg and Wasserman stepped down. And he would come back to CAA and give these kind of master classes once a month. And during one of his early, you know, within the first year or two, he said, you know, what I learned is that, you know, Sid and Lou, they were there for 25 years. And if there's anything I know, it's that nobody should be running a studio or even a company for 25 years, because there's just so much that's wrong and so much kind of goes by the way. It becomes habitual and some really bad cultural things just, you know. Meanwhile, cut to Ron Meyer, who's been there nearly 30 years.
Has he?
Yes, no. And he's tried to leave. In his defense, he has been saying for years, like, look, this is it. I am leaving. And then they keep, you know, merging with another company. And they're like, please stay for another 5 years. And he's like, fine. But he has said for years he's wanted to get, you know, to retire.
Wow. Is he really? How long has he been at Universal?
1994. So that would be 2004, 2014. It's well over 25 years at this point.
25 years. Wow, you're right. I can't believe that was 25 years ago. That's how long ago Mike Ovitz was in his prime, right?
That's how old those suits are in the back of my closet.
Exactly. Well, you know, Jan Michael Vincent slipped by the world until it slipped, you know, until somebody finally noticed and talked about it and brought it to everyone's attention. Ken Nordine did not. He was covered, but somehow I missed it. I don't know how. But Ken Nordine was a voiceover artist and did lots of TV commercials and ads. But he was best known for being the creator of Word Jazz. And he died at 98. I suddenly, like 4 days ago, said, Ken Nordine still alive? And I looked it up and was like, just died. I was like, son of a, oh man. So he crossed over into mainstream culture with his Word Jazz albums. Those were recordings of his sort of original beatnik style poetry set to the sounds of cool jazz played by the likes of Chico Hamilton. It sounds like the stuff that would sort of date quickly, but he wasn't political and he wasn't, you know, pompous. It was playful. It was fun. Was philosophical, and he had such a beautiful voice that stuff ages really, really well. And he collaborated with not just jazz artists, but Laurie Anderson, and Bowie had him do the Highline Festival, and he played with Grateful Dead, Jerry Garcia. He played on a couple albums of Ken's. So he had a really interesting career. He did tons of commercials, sometimes writing the text, and he really popped up all over the place. Fred Astaire danced to one of his songs on a TV special. Sesame Street. He worked on Sesame Street, of course. For Laurie Anderson, they would collaborate via Skype. She'd be on the stage, and then he would Skype in, and they did this segment called Mr. and Mrs. God. I'm imagining she did that computer voice that she does every once in a while. You know, I want to wonder, you know, that great character she does. And so they played Mr. and Mrs. God, and I got to know him because of Stay Awake. Stay Awake is a tribute album to the music and songs from Walt Disney films. It was organized by Hal Wilner, and all the hip artists of the day on it, Los Lobos, R.A.M., Suzanne Vega, you name it. But there was Ken Nordine at the beginning and the end doing these hypnotic little essays. There we are now. It all ends. You know, it's just like, it was so cool. And he'd work in like, hi, diddle, diddle. And you're like, who is this guy? What is this? This is so cool. And that's how I found out who he was and got to know him. And apparently, for 40 years, he did a show that aired on a radio program called Word Jazz that aired on WBEZ. That's the very station he began at right after college working the mimeograph machine. And you can hear it every Sunday night. They do reruns at midnight Central Time. So if you're intrigued to hear what Ken Nordine might be like, you know, check out WBEZ and Sunday at midnight, you can hear his show.
I wonder if it was like Joe Frank.
Joe Frank?
Yeah. Look up Joe Frank And tell me how close that is. Joe Frank is a DJ who did these like long-winded stories with like music in the background, and on Saturday nights it was like first person sometimes, and you know, you just,
well, that's like, not like that at all. These are like 2-minute, 3-minute bits. These,
oh yeah,
are,
no, no,
these are songs and poems.
Yeah, no, okay, well,
but I'll check him out. That sounds interesting. But yeah, Ken Nordine, a very cool character. I saw a documentary about him online, like a 10-minute interview. He was 90, still doing stuff, still recording stuff. I played an album from 1979. It sounded great. Really cool.
Well, hopefully when we're 90, we're still recording. I don't know whether this new technology that we're using, this Squadcast, will work or not. So we're going to find that out. So hopefully we have a show.
We'll be in hologram form.
Yeah, but you know what? Actually, if you'll know whether we have a show if you subscribe to us on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher, or anywhere they give podcasts away for free. Please do rate and review us in those podcast aggregators. It helps us out when you do. It helps others find the show when you do. Again, please do subscribe to us in any one of those podcast aggregators. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as links to the work of Jonathan Handel, of counsel, as I now know to call it, of counsel at Troy Gould, and of course a contributing editor at The Hollywood Reporter. I'd like to thank him for joining us. You can also find ways to contact us on our website, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. On Twitter, we're at Showbiz Sandbox, and on Facebook, we're just Showbiz Sandbox. Facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox is where you can find our page. Again, all of that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's wordjazz.com.
Which is probably, actually,
it's Ken Nordine's website.
Oh,
it'll
okay.
It'll send you to a link to YouTube where you can watch a lot of his songs.
Okay, well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage there, any of his coverage of the entertainment industry on wordjazz.com, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of it is aggregated. Of course, you should check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading, and hopefully that'll be up soon. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.